Well, KPDZ will be joining just in a few moments here. The Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19. And that's live from the County Courthouse. I want to remind you that this is KPDZ in Port Townsend. Dr. Tom Locke, Public Health Officer for Jefferson County, and Willie Bentz, Director of Emergency Management, provide information and guidance in order to minimize the effects of the outbreak in our county. So we're going to move on into the Board of Commissioners meeting in progress.
How'd that look?
That's good.
Yep.
All right, let me kind of hop. This is the ARCOR implementation. It's $1 million over 3 years. So we've been working with the Behavioral Health Consortium. I don't know if you guys remember, but the Board of Health put me as the Board of Health representative on this group. It was just, 100 professionals and me, basically, from the Behavioral Health Consortium. Law enforcement and mental health and the hospital. I mean, everyone just knew their stuff and has been working in this. So really good group working on, the grant application. It kind of, this breaks each of the areas you have to do, prevention, recovery, and treatment. Mm-hmm. So these are some of the, I'll send Philip this deck to share. It's public. Bringing syringe exchange to the South County is that. More research on the feasibility of the crisis stabilization. You know, as, this is what I was talking about. So we're doing our due diligence before we jump into what would be a massive project in Jefferson County. And then kind of just following all of our existing processes through. Everyone's really pleased with the Navigator system so far, with the Port Townsend Police that are 0.1% is partially funding, as well as the city. So, but that Navigator process looks like it needs case management as well for kind of wraparound services. We're getting jail to community service, so getting, when you get out of jail, there's a behavioral health counselor right there to help you get you to the next place. This is the Behavioral Health Consortium members. We've got all of law enforcement, fire, all the players. And we'll know basically by it's from HRSA, right?
That's great. It'd be wonderful to have more stable funding, 3-year funding to
implement. My screen off. You don't see my screen anymore, do you?
Nope, you're good.
Great. Really interesting, and it's great to see the work doesn't go away just because we're all at home, so it's really gratifying to see them moving forward.
I never thought I would miss meetings as much as I do. And just seeing our colleagues. It's a strangely disconnected time.
Yeah, that fatigue is very real. I mean, and as we go into phase two, Sunday, I asked my daughter, so you want to set up a play date with someone? And, she had a duck that passed, so she was painting a gravestone for it, and she had stuff she wanted to do, and I think it's going to take a lot of us a while to really jump into the great outdoors. Mm-hmm. So we're expecting to be joined by Dr. Locke and Willie Bentz, I guess.
They're both on.
Good morning, Dr. Locke.
Ta-da!
Of course.
We're just waiting for our cue here.
We're getting down. We're going to be like a choreographed stage show by the time we're done. Thank you for joining us, and I assume we have the listeners of KPTZ with us as well. And it's been a momentous weekend, so we've been eagerly awaiting this opportunity to pepper you with questions. But we'll hand it to you first, Dr. Locke.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. So as everyone heard, Jefferson County's variance application was accepted and it has been approved. And that brought Washington State now to 21 counties that have moved into phase two of the state's reopening plan. And that includes our neighbors, Island County and Mason County. And I think it has also has been pretty well distributed. Clallam definitely, and very likely Kitsap, will put in applications this week. So our concern in Jefferson County of being the only county in northwestern Washington that was open, as things have played out, it's not going to look that way. So it looks like this period that we are holding back on camping and certain business activities may not last very long at all. And that will be fine. Well, let me just start with the larger perspective, as I often do. We're now in the U.S., we're approaching the 100,000 fatality mark for COVID-19. And this is getting near the death toll for the two large the influenza pandemics of 1968 and 1957, you know, where we saw mortality rate in the 100,000 range, but we're, as we all know, we're still in the very beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. So we expect that number to keep going up and up. In fact, one of the most recent studies just released last week was that this infection is not in control in at least 24 states in the U.S. And what that means is the reproductive number, the R naught is greater than one in those states. So each case is producing more than one case, and the epidemic is growing, and it's moving into more rural parts of the country, especially in the South and the Midwest, as unfortunately we knew it would do. Geography offers some protection and dispersed population, but it's not absolute protection. You know, ultimately, it comes down to personal behaviors is what protects people. Here in Washington State, we're over 20,000 cases. We've had almost 3,300 deaths. So we have a case fatality rate of 5.3%. And this, of course, is just the diagnosed cases. We're pretty certain at this point that there are at least 10 times more infections than our case count. So the infection fatality rate for this is, we're now generally using the figure anywhere from 0.5% to 1%. So anywhere from 5 in 1,000 to 10 in 1,000. People die from this infection, and that's 5 to 10 times worse than influenza. In Jefferson County, we've been holding steady at a case count of 30. The number of tests we've done and gotten results from is now well over 1,000, 1,372. So our percentage positive continues to drop. We're now at 2.2% of our tests are coming back positive, which is less than half actually a third of the state rate. The state rate is currently 6.1%. So that's all getting better. I won't go through the reopening phase two, what it involves. I think that information is pretty much out there. We're putting it on websites, but I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions. about that. This week is the week we're going to do a big push on masking. There are three counties that have masking directives or mandates. So King, Whatcom, and San Juan. For King and Whatcom, it's a health officer directive that is really based on voluntary compliance. In San Juan, there's actually a penalty. So it's a misdemeanor violation to not wear a mask in situations where it's required, unless you have an exemption to wearing that. Unfortunately, we're continuing to see the polarization, the use of masking and other public health measures are being used as a partisan wedge issue by some people. I think that's it's more than unfortunate. It's a basic failure to understand that public health and personal liberty are not in opposition to one another. They're in balance with one another. We always give up a certain amount of personal liberty for public safety. You know, we don't drive 70 miles an hour through school zones, even though that would be a expression of personal liberty. It's also would be very dangerous, and so it's that way. I actually went through SQUIM this weekend and saw there was a protest with the, you know, give me liberty or give me death was one of the signs, and I thought they had it almost right, because what they're really asking for, if they thought about it, was give me liberty and give me death, you know, give me the opportunity to put other people at risk. And that's going to be the big communication challenge we have with masking, is to get across the idea this is not an expression of personal liberty to not wear a mask. It's not an expression of personal risk tolerance. Really, masking is about the social contract. It's about people agreeing to protect each other by engaging in a practice that only works really well if everyone does it. I think this is especially true in situations like grocery stores and pharmacies and places where we are asking these workers, these essential workers, to put themselves on the front line continuously and see a random assortment of community members, some of whom will be carrying the infection without symptoms. And so the way we show our gratitude for them keeping society up and running is to wear masks. It's a kind of a courtesy that we do for each other. And we'll be trying to explore different ways of getting that point across and making this into the social norm. You know, that's kind of how we did it with cigarettes, that it eventually became the social norm that you don't smoke in places where other people will be exposed to your smoke. And this is equally, if not more, important, but we don't have years and years to change this normative behavior. We have to do it in weeks, really. We'll be seeing this a lot more as we open up, and there are a number of requirements for masking that go along with the state guidances for businesses and for restaurants and other indoor places.
KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend.
This last week, from a transmission standpoint, CDC came out with some study results that are saying that the coronavirus is not transmitted as easily as we thought through contaminated surfaces. So that doesn't mean it's no longer important to wash your hands or to disinfect surfaces, but we don't see that as the real driver for this. It's more and more the evidence is saying that close proximity, and probably with some these aerosols that we generate just in normal speech, when you're infected, those aerosols become carriers of the virus, and so it makes it all the more important that we adhere to the physical distancing, and when that's not possible, the masking directives. So we're heading into reopening, and I just want everyone to understand that this involves risk. You know, as we all read the comments we received last week from the public, and a number of people did not want us to reopen at all. I can understand that fear, but it's keeping everything closed was never a long-range plan. It was just a desperate measure we had to take to prevent the surge from overwhelming our healthcare system. And now we have to start taking risks and learning to control those risks, and including with tourism. Tourists will come to the Olympic Peninsula. It's a beautiful destination, and we need to be prepared for that. At Jefferson County Public Health, at the hospital, we've certainly spent this time preparing ourselves for dealing with outbreaks, you know, if and when they occur. We're prepared to do that, but this is not something that just the health department or the medical care system can deal with. We can deal with part of it, but really what's going to determine how successful we are in moving through phase two and then hopefully getting to phase three sometime in the summer, you know, hopefully in early to mid-July, it's going to be how well we do as a community to with the masking and the physical distance and when we have to isolate or quarantine people, how good a job we do of taking care of each other, of supporting people who are in isolation and quarantine, providing volunteer services and chore service and all these things that make it possible for you to interrupt your life for 2 weeks and stay in quarantine. That's really going to be our test as a community. There are a number of people, I get this question again and again, you know, how much will the summer weather help us? And it probably is a factor, not a decisive one, but it helps. And especially the outdoor component, the more time people spend outdoors, not only is that healthier in many respects, but it also, it makes it harder to transmit the virus. The sunlight and the air currents and even the kind of weather we've been having this last weekend, high humidity weather actually makes it harder for the virus to be transmitted. And that may sound counterintuitive, but the way that works is when the humidity is high, the respiratory aerosols we generate are heavier. So they pick up that humidity and they fall to the ground faster. And when the climate is really dry, as occurs in the winter or even you can have dry times in the summer, that favors virus transmission because then the particles we expel, they dry out faster and they float in the air longer. So high humidity is actually good from a standpoint of preventing transmission. But at this point, nobody thinks this virus is going to disappear over the summer. It's just that we're going to things are going to be a little less favorable for transmission. So hopefully we'll be more successful in controlling things. So I'll leave it at that for my remarks and be happy to try to address any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Locke. David, do you have any questions? Hey there, David.
Can't hear you.
Yeah, can't hear you, David. Well, okay, I think there was no questions. Kate?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Locke. I have a couple questions for you, very different in nature. I was getting a lot of questions on interpretation of phase two, of our plan for phase two. And one that kept coming up again and again is, what is the difference between what we call gatherings, and I realize this is from the state language, versus outdoor recreation? One specifies once per week, the other does not. And I have my own understanding of it, but I think it would be helpful if you could explain why those are different and what that's the kind of risk that that's based on.
Right. It took me a while to figure out even the language of the first one. So the outdoor guidance is fewer than five, and which most people call that four. But I think the meaning of that was it's fewer than five besides yourself. So it actually means five people, yourself and up to four others. So the outdoor guidance is the maximum group size is you plus up to four other people who are not in your household. And then you're presumably anyone in your household wouldn't count. So you could have a larger group than that. If they were household members,
so I think two families of four could congregate outside together.
Yes, exactly. And then the gathering, and I don't know how enforceable this is going to be because, but it's really a recommendation. So no more than five outside your household. It really, that's a matter of trying to contain risk, is that every person outside your household increases your risk of exposure, especially when we're dealing with this infection where at least 25% now we're thinking of people who have it asymptomatically. And when you factor in people who are spreading pre-symptomatic, people who are going to get sick but aren't sick yet, it may be as high as 50% of the infection. So that's why you just can't assume that people outside your household are uninfected. And that's what these are all about. It's just to try to get people to go slow when it comes to mingling of households, because that's one of the things that, you know, if people do that really aggressively, we'll see more cases. But it's really the only ones who know that information are the people themselves. There's not going to be police out there asking you to verify how many non-household members you've been exposed to each week.
You're muted, Kate.
Thank you. So gatherings could be indoors, correct? And is there an assumption that there would be a higher risk gathering being people getting together, perhaps talking more intimately versus outdoor recreation, which might be more active and less likely to transmit?
Yes. Indoor has greater risk than outdoor. And the presumption in all of this is that people are doing these other things to avoid transmission. So even when you're getting together with non-household members, you're trying to maintain that six-foot buffer, or if you can, wearing masks. And it's more important to wear masks indoors than outdoors, because the risk is greater. The airborne particles have sort of a they're more concentrated, and they don't move around as much in indoor settings.
Okay. Related to that point, I'm hearing a lot of consternation and even kind of weaponizing of the World Health Organization's adherence to their principle that healthy people only need to wear a mask if they are caring for someone who is sick. Do you understand the kind of politics behind that, why the CDC and the World Health Organization are on such different planets when it comes to that recommendation?
No, I don't. I haven't. I know that the World Health Organization, the evidence that they base that on is somewhat older. Their report came out in early April, and the evidence on this has actually been shifting as people have been doing engineering studies and finding that masks are really better than we thought for source control. And also that asymptomatic, presymptomatic transmission is a much bigger factor than we thought. I expect the World Health Organization is going to revise their guidelines at some point, because they seem to be approaching this from a standpoint of personal protection. Mm-hmm. So that's true. Cloth masks do not offer a lot of personal protection to the person wearing them. And so from that perspective, you don't really promote them. As it turns out, mask use is and has always been much more popular internationally than it's been in the U.S. And the countries that really have the best track record with this, South Korea and Taiwan, it's virtually universal. And it's a long-standing cultural practice. So, bottom line, I expect the World Health Organization will change their position in time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Greg, did you want to ask questions from KPTZ? Or are you going to hold up?
I do not see any. I don't think we have a good way for getting questions. Usually they send them ahead of time, but we'll ask for them for our meeting next week.
We do have. I at least got some.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
It'd come back.
And get to KPTZ. We've all been reading, continually evolving information, Dr. Locke, about how this spreads, and I read a report from a microbiologist, I think Aaron Bromage, has been kind of going around that talks about a CDC report about a particular outbreak in a restaurant in Guangzhou, China, and talking about, in a windowless room with an air conditioning flow, and talking for 50 or an hour and a half, almost everyone at the table got infected, and there was very high transmission downwind on the air conditioner path, and a little bit of transmission, infection that happened in kind of the backwash, but out of the path of the airflow, there were no infections, I believe. And I'm wondering if this kind of data, this sort of empirical data, is as valuable as others, and if it can inform our processes as we help, businesses stand up. Even now, should we be looking at airflow in these areas, inside stores as they look to reopen, inside restaurants? Is that an important avenue to pursue currently?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's how we're learning about this, is through these real life case studies. And we have an office outbreak in South Korea that's been very well researched, and we've had a number of outbreaks at funeral gatherings and at religious ceremonies, and each one, we, you know, in medicine we call these natural experiments. They're things that we wouldn't ethically do on our own, but when they happen, we try to learn from them. And what it's telling us is that airborne spread is a significant factor, and therefore what we do in terms of ventilation and how we separate people spatially is important, and it's driving a number of different things. People are doing studies of, you know, using air purifiers and ultraviolet light disinfection and more use of negative pressure ventilation systems and all of these things to see if those might be factors. Because anything we can do through engineering controls, where we re-engineer the environment to make it safer, it doesn't depend on individual behavior. It's something that it benefits everyone, and no one has to think about it. So anything like that is worth doing if we have evidence to support the benefit. But right now, one of our cheapest ways to get at that is going to be to encourage outdoor dining. So just to take advantage of the dispersion factors that occur outdoors. And for indoor dining, we're definitely going to be looking at ventilation and trying to optimize that as much as possible. Because one of the challenges in dining is, you know, you can't eat with a mask on.
Mm-hmm. And then the other issue that I found in this particular article really intriguing as I try to wrap my head around this is kind of the cumulative load. I think they said 1,000 viral particles in an hour. You know, it's kind of load plus time, and it's an accumulation. So that's why, say, a cashier at a grocery store might have a higher risk of exposure, because they might get a little bit from, you know, 100 different unmasked customers in a an hour, say. So I guess I just want to reiterate, or have you reiterate, that the fomitic transfer, the surface transfer, looks like it's less. It looks like it's more from just kind of talking and you know, aerosolizing our droplets in normal environments, you know, not just the incubation rooms. And that the best way to keep our cashiers and everything safe is to wear a mask when you go into a store.
Yeah, absolutely. There, as you point out, there are a number of variables. It's not just distance. It's not just masking or not masking. Time is a major factor. Airflow is a major factor. There's all these other issues of light and humidity, and all of those things, they have an additive effect. We're actually learning with this that dose exposure and route of exposure appears to be a significant predictor of severity of disease. So very low dose exposures are less likely to cause infection. But if they do, the infection is milder. You know, our immune system essentially has more time to react to the virus, because it takes time for the virus to replicate in our system, and that gives our immune system a head start. Whereas the worst kind of exposure are these high dose aerosols that we inhale directly into our lungs. And these are the kind of things that healthcare workers can be exposed to, why we have to be so careful in those kind of settings. Or we think that's what was happening in New York, in this very dense, crowded urban environments of subways and crowded streets. That's why things were so bad in New York, is people got all these high-dose airborne exposures. So the flip side of all of this, what we learned from it, is if we can, the more we reduce, everything we do that reduces the time and the intensity of exposure, the fewer cases we'll have, and the milder the cases will be. So I think that's...
You're listening to Dr. Tom Locke, Board of Commissioners, Jefferson County Board of Commissioners Public Health Update on KPTZ.
Masking. That, you know, even though masking's never going to be 100%, some people medically just cannot wear masks, and they'll be exempt from any directives. But every additional person that wears a mask reduces the risk for everyone. So you're doing something that benefits others, and when others do it, they're benefiting you. And that's kind of a definition of what public health is about. You know, we all make sacrifices so that all of us can be healthier.
Great. Thank you very much for that clarification. Yes, Philip?
So, Dr. Locke, on the issue of masking, can you inform us of where you are on considering issuing a public health officer order regarding indoor masking?
Yes, I'm writing it today. So I've gone through a number of different models to kind of find the right combination for Jefferson County. So I'll, you know, I think Wednesday or Thursday, so tomorrow or the next day, I will put that out. It's not a panacea, because, you know, we have to motivate people to do this. We have to follow it up with a lot of public education, but it's already required for the, you know, the businesses that as they reopen, there are some masking mandates that are built in to those guidance, the guidance that they're required to follow when they open up.
Yeah, on that, the sooner I think that an order could come out that would be helpful, the sooner we can link it up with the phase two initiation. And the Chamber of Commerce is launching shortly a JEFCO Cares public outreach program to the businesses. And it would be important for being able to message in that if masking is going to be mandated for indoor businesses, it would be important to know that so that that could be part of the JEFCO Cares business outreach education program.
And I'm asking Dr. Locke, this is, I'm sorry if you just said it, but it's going to be, you don't want citations associated with it, or I mean, what kind of enforcement do you foresee being most effective with this?
I think the next step should be a King County, Whatcom County one. I think that, you know, given the opposition to this, you know, trying to enforce it with criminal penalties is likely to have some negative effects. I'm not opposed to that, but I think that's more a plan B than a plan A. If plan A doesn't work, and as I said, there already are requirements for businesses built into the guidance. But in response to Mr. Morley, I think we can have this done by, I can have it done by tomorrow. So from a planning standpoint, we'll do that. But from my perspective, the directive is kind of the next step in this, and what's really going to make it work is the public education campaign. Mm-hmm. And the more the more successful we are as a community for people to persuade each other that this is the right thing to do, that it's not a reasonable political statement to go around jeopardizing other people's health, to make your point politically.
Thank you. I think it's really important backup for our local businesses to be able to say there's a health order here that requires it. But of course, then that puts at risk those business owners to have to be in an enforcement role, which is not safe. And so I asked Dr. Lothi on our call Friday afternoon. I said, is there any research being done into kind of the social marketing around messaging to get compliance? And she wasn't familiar with any, but if that's something you're familiar with, Dr. Locke, I would hope that might inform the chamber's efforts and this kind of countywide approach that we're taking. Are you familiar with any successes?
I've been watching King County, especially on this. This is just starting to take off nationally, so we don't have anything, or I have not seen anything that I would call a best practice, which just means we have to be kind of creative on this locally. But I think I think we want to have events. We want to do mass giveaways. We want to promote things as much as possible. I was at one yesterday. There's a group in here in Clallam County called the Mask Fairies, who make masks and then dress up very colorfully as fairies and give them out for free. They were at the Safeway in Port Angeles. They're willing to come to Port Townsend and have a mask fairy event and things like that. It has a lighthearted kind of component to it, but it's things like that. If we can get creative and get the community mobilized around it, I'm hopeful this will be better than taking a punitive approach, which some people want to pick a fight over this issue, and we don't want to put store owners in that position. We want to try to de-escalate that opposition, and just urge people, fight about something else. Don't fight about this. This is a public health issue.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Dr. Locke. We got a little bit of time. Let's run through some of the questions from KPTZ. I'll bump into one that I continually hear too. If there are still people in town who say that they are experiencing symptoms of COVID-19 listed by the CDC but have not been able to get a test, what are the criteria for getting tested?
The criteria, virtually always, if you have a fever with any other symptoms, we want to test you. A fever is a reliable sign of infection. It gets more situational when people don't have fevers, but they have a cough or a headache or a sore throat. Then they'll usually be asked more questions to just try to narrow down, is this an allergy or some non-infectious cause? But we're struggling with this. Several months ago, we were in a shortage situation where we were not able to test everyone we wanted to. Now, fortunately, we are able to, but we're still making that transition. So we've gotten very few complaints of this, and when we have those that we've had, we've referred those to the hospital. We're very willing to help people with this, to give them a second opinion, as it were. You know, if they think they should be tested and they've somehow been turned down. But I think a lot of that's just from a transitional standpoint. And some people mistakenly want to be tested when they don't really have symptoms or risk factors. And, you know, they're picking that up from the national news. You know, when they have political leaders who are tested every day, that does not make any sense medically. And we don't recommend that to people. The test isn't even 100% sensitive. So it's much more likely to be meaningful if people have symptoms. So again, I think the hospital they're doing a good job at the on the hotline, but if people have concerns, I've been inviting them to contact us at the health department, and we'll try to make sure that everyone who needs to be tested does in fact get tested.
This is KPTZ 91.9 in Port Townsend.
4-degree fever as well as other symptoms. Now you'll probably get tested. Is that?
Yes. That's the group we especially want to target, because we're out of the flu season. We still see common colds in the summer. In fact, some of these what we call seasonal coronaviruses, the non-COVID-19 coronaviruses, some of them circulate in the summertime. So we can still see people. In fact, the majority of people who have fevers and respiratory symptoms are going to end up having something other than COVID-19. But as we open up, it's even more important that we find every case and we isolate and quarantine so that we continue to suppress the infection in our county.
Great, thank you. Running through a few more questions from KPTZ quickly. Let's see, I think you've addressed your intentions on masks. Are there standardized practices that businesses are being held to, such as wiping tables after each use for tablets after each use for payment, wiping surfaces on credit card machines and self-service checkout stands? How is public health monitoring social distancing and mask wearing in high volume businesses such as coffee houses and food stores? I know you've spoken to this, but I think it bears repetition.
Yeah, those are why we've depended very heavily on these very very carefully constructed state guidance documents, and it might help people to know how those are being developed. Is, you know, it's not someone just sitting in a room thinking up good ideas. These are whole groups of people, including restaurant owners and people who actually work in these different situations, kind of working, developing and then troubleshooting and editing these documents. A lot of people putting their heads together and coming up with the very best strategy that they can. And so as you go to the governor's website and read these documents, I think what people are that really struck with is how incredibly detailed they are in terms of, cleaning cycles and what you do in these settings. Because ultimately, like restaurant practices, we're never going to have a public health presence where we can't inspect restaurants every day or, you know, several times a day. In fact, we generally inspect restaurants once or twice a year. What we're really doing in those inspections is teaching people how to do, maintain food safety, all year long. And it's going to be the same way with businesses and coronavirus prevention. Is people have to learn to do this, and and motivate them themselves to do it consistently. Because, you know, not only will public health never have the workforce to be out there inspecting things, it's not gonna be a good use of our resources. Really, we need to focus on prevention and response. And we're at the health department, we're focusing too on getting our other services back up and running, vaccination programs and family planning. The rates of vaccination have been plummeting statewide and nationally, and if we don't reverse that, we're not only going to be dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, we're going to be dealing with mumps and measles and pertussis outbreaks. So we can't afford to not pay attention to those things.
Great, thank you, Dr. Locke. And so to reiterate, we're working actively to help educate businesses, but we are not policing that they put all those state guidelines in specifically. We just don't have the capacity.
It has to be compliance-based, citizens, you know, who believe that a business is not following the guidelines, you know, are free to lodge complaints, and especially if it's a restaurant or a grocery store where we have a defined regulatory responsibility, we would respond to those.
Dr. Locke, the primary place for complaining, though, is through the state web link, and the state has taken on primary responsibility for businesses that are not in compliance with phase one or phase two.
Yes, that's true. And then it's all of this is an exercise of the governor's authority. So the enforcement is primarily with them, although I would say with licensed food service establishments, because we issue their license, because we inspect them, we have a defined legal role in that. And these regulations are now kind of an additional set of requirements that they are operating under.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, construction is being regulated by Labor and Industries, so a separate regulatory framework. But, you know, my hope in all of this is that I hope that businesses and consumers see themselves as partners in this, that we're going to have businesses working with us who are trying to do the right thing and are really implementing those. And then consumers have to do their part too. You know, if restaurants are willing to open, are people going to be willing to not crowd? And where that enforcement question comes from. And I think this is a case too where customers might need to be willing to say politely, hey, I'm a little uncomfortable that I see that you're not wearing a mask. I think that's part of the requirement. You know, just like we have to somehow find a way to gently hold one another accountable for this approach to public health and reopening.
Yeah, I think so. And this is where I think free masks as much as possible are going to be important because that's one of the ways to do it gently is to give a person a mask, and ask them to use it. I've seen that work in many settings. You know, sometimes the reason that people are not masked is because they don't have one or they forgot to bring it with them. That sorts of things. So we want to identify the barriers and address them as much as possible.
All right, quickly getting through the library questions. I'm showing my hand. Through the radio station questions, they were asking about libraries and child cares and day camps. I mean, a library can start curbside service now, yeah?
Uh, Correct. That's my understanding. Daycares have actually always been open, they're on the list of essential services. I should say many of them closed because they didn't have enough business, but they didn't close because they were required to close. So they can open whenever they want to, whenever they find it's sustainable.
For 15 kids?
I don't believe that there is a number restriction on daycare. I think they're because it just may not be feasible for them to operate under certain levels. And you know what? One of the reasons that daycare was on the essential list is that it's important for parents who are essential workers to be able to work. They need somewhere where their kids will be cared for. Libraries as a group are phase three. So they're not open as public gathering spots, but yes, as you say, they can do curbside book lending.
Great, and we'll talk a little bit more, you know, amongst ourselves about industry standards and, you know, enforcement and everything. Anyone else have any other last questions for Dr. Locke before we pass over to Willie? All right. Well, thank you very much for all your work, Dr. Locke. Keep it up. Look forward to the masking guidelines coming up soon, and we'll pass it over to our Department of Emergency Management Supervisor, Willie Benz.
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner. So, you know, the past couple of weeks, I've mentioned we've been taking a little bit of a break to kind of assess where we're at in our response internally, put together a little bit of what we call an after-action report to discuss ways we can improve in the future. That's just about wrapped up. I won't go into too many details on it in this format because I want to brief some of our internal stakeholders first. So commissioners and Philip and Dr. Locke, you know, we'll be talking a little bit about some of our findings this week, and then I'll share a little bit more on the public side at the meeting next week. But we're happy to have that kind of wrapped up and improve a bit moving forward. Other than that, you know, most of what we've been doing
And you will be able to hear the rest of the reports. We were bringing you the public health updates on COVID-19 live from Jefferson County Board of Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. And the recording of today's reports will be available later today, streaming online at kptz.org. Thanks for listening.